Hi everyone, it's Lael here, and before we dive into this week's episode, I just wanted to tell you about my upcoming mentorship that is starting in February 2026. The Journey is an 8-month online live program designed to help you unpack your stories, understand your imprints, and dive deeper into your life and explore what is working and what isn't. This is professional and personal development. Each month includes things like guided meditations and somatic practices, journal prompts and reflection exercises, group sharing and witnessing, individual coaching demonstrations, expert guest speakers, integration exercises, community support, personal mentoring from me, practical tools and techniques, and loads of resources for deeper exploration. I walk beside you for the 8 months, answering all your questions and supporting you to come home to yourself. If you are interested, please visit my website at laelstone.com.au. I would love to journey with you. And now, on to this week's episode.
Ah, the human experience, with our flaws, our passions, our triggers, our inspirations, and our imprints. If we could see behind everyone's story, then perhaps what we would have is deep compassion. In this podcast, I get the chance to explore these stories from some truly fascinating people in some honest and heartwarming conversations. And best of all, I get to share these discussions with you. I'm Lael Stone, and this is Humans Being.
Welcome to Humans Being. I'm Lael Stone. It's a pleasure to have you with me. This week, I have been contemplating my humanness around learning to receive, which is something that I've managed to master only recently, because for a long time, I was far more comfortable being in the position of giving. And I think when you are a person that, you know, you're being a counselor, listening to people's feelings, we can often feel more comfortable being in the place where you're helping people, not necessarily being in that space where we actually receive. And it's interesting, being a pretty competent woman, doing lots of stuff in the world, you know, I think my thoughts have been, I don't need anyone, I'm good. You know, I can take care of myself, I can be of service, it kind of fills me up. Yet I am beginning to realize that that can actually be a bit detrimental to yourself, because receiving is just as important as giving. And I think what I have had to work on around that receiving, I've tried to really do that with my kids. And one of the most beautiful things that we have done as a family for a really long time, ever since our kids were really little, is every time it's their birthday, we sit around the table and each member of our family, even extended family, will say to that birthday child what it is that we admire about them, what it is that we love them for, what is it that we see in them. And it has been such an amazing thing to do for, maybe we've done it for like maybe 18, 20 years now, but each year watching my children just receive those compliments, receive that love, take that in, they sit there with so much grace just receiving. And yet there's times when it's been my birthday and the family's going to say it and I'm like, oh, no, it's good, you know, I try to avoid it, don't really want to take it in. And I realize there's an art to receiving, and that's something that I've really been thinking about recently in all the giving that I do, which I love doing. I'm realizing just how important it is for that exchange to be there where we actually do allow ourselves to receive. So that has been my contemplation of being human this week, is about how well do we receive? Are we comfortable receiving? What does it feel like for you? Are you much more comfortable giving than you are taking in? So I'm going to leave that little thought with you. Now, my guest today is someone that many people have said to me, I would love you and Billy to sit down and just have a very, very long conversation. My guest today is the amazing Billy Garvey. Thank you for being here, Billy. I'm just going to read out a little bit of Billy's bio. If you don't know who he is, I'm just going to read out a little bit about him. Dr. Billy Garvey is a developmental pediatrician with over 20 years' experience working with children and families. He's a senior specialist at ABC's Families, trains clinicians, and conducts research in child development and mental health. He's the author of the number one best-selling parenting book, 10 Things I Wish You Knew About Your Child's Mental Health, which has sold over 60,000 copies. That's really epic. That is amazing. Billy is also the co-founder and co-host of the popular podcast, Pop Culture Parenting, which I know many people who follow me also absolutely love that podcast. And he's a father of three beautiful little humans, and he's passionate about reassuring parents that there is no such thing as a bad child. I first met Billy when we were filming the documentary Seam, and that's when we first met. We met in the airport.
Oh, I knew that.
We met in the airport because we were both flying up to Queensland to film, and the producer Sam's like, oh, Billy's going to be on the same flight as you. And I remember getting to the airport and we'd never met, and I was wandering around like, where is this Billy gone? And then we had a quick conversation before we got on the plane. And then we were literally there for like 24 hours. We were filming and we sat and talked, and we were both like, oh, we probably need a lot more time than just this to break stuff down.
It's funny. I feel like I've known you for years and years, but yeah, it's funny. Often people see me and they're like, where is this Billy guy? Where's that doctor?
It
couldn't be that guy.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And it was, I think, I feel like there's such a beautiful crossover with our work. Like, we have done a few gigs and stuff, speaking things together over the time. But before I jump into that part about what I was just sharing then about receiving, and is that something that is familiar to you? Do you feel that you can take in stuff and receiving, or are you far more about the giving?
Yeah, I definitely, and I completely relate to it. As you're saying it, I was, reflecting, on my childhood, the work that I do in Clinic with Kids, why I'm doing that and how it relates to my childhood, on that context of like, it's very quick to go deep into the topic, but I'm not very capable of receiving support, and that comes from my childhood, and that's still all this time later, I can't sit comfortably in that space. And I was like, it's very quick to go very heavy.
I'm like, I was going to go, let's just keep it light, but let's go.
Well, no, I was recently talking about, to my therapist about how I feel invincible, because he was talking about this little Billy who's, just hasn't healed and all this stuff. And I was like, I don't relate to that. I feel invincible. And he was just phenomenally saying it's because it's so scary to open that up. And that's a bit of it. I can't be relying upon anyone. Mm. I can't receive. I can only give. There's a shame component to it. It's about like, I have to prove that I'm a good person. Yeah. Just giving. I can't take. Mm. If I take, I might lose relationships. And that comes from my attachment and the insecurity in that. And I meet kids every day that have the same. And that's part of my healing process, is getting to meet those kids and give them a different story to mine. That's why I selfishly do what I do. Like, I don't want ever anything that I'm doing, whether it's the advocacy and my clinical work, to come across as I'm this great person. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it for me. Like, I say that in clinic. I'm like, it's a real privilege to do this, and I'm getting paid for it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very lucky that I've been doing this for a long time, and every single minute I'm in clinic, I genuinely, I'm not saying it performatively, I genuinely feel like it's a privilege to be meeting these kids.
Yeah.
Like, but it's because of me. It's about me, you know what I mean? It's almost like this egotistical.
Yeah, there's that saying, we teach what we most need to know, which is about the integration. I feel in the way I look at it is that, as you are doing that work, and I relate to that in my work, it has been so much about my own healing, my own growth of who I want to be, by sitting in these spaces with parents or with adults, holding that tenderness for them around their vulnerability and healing, because I learn just as much from it, and it's been helping me heal my own stuff as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was at a dinner with, there was eight of us, and I was with Dan Siegel, who's a friend, and people might know him, but he's amazing, like whole brain child. And there was myself, him, and six other people that all work in child trauma, like clinicians and researchers. And we just asked everyone at the table, why do you do the work you do? And every single one of us, it was because of childhood trauma.
Yeah.
And the second question was, do you look back and feel like you've accomplished something?
Mm-hmm.
And every single person but me said yes.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's this really interesting thing about how, like, I've still got so far to go with that, And it's an interesting thing, because even with my therapist, I was like, he's like, I'm confident that you will get to that point where you can expose that vulnerability in you and ask people for help and all of that stuff. And I was like, I can't see that. And I, to be honest, I kind of made peace with it. I'm just like, that, you know, I'm happy. I have enough joy in my life and everything that I'm cool to walk around with that armor and just be like, that's, but now I can, I'm cool that it goes towards other kids and that's how I make peace with it. But it's, because I don't know if you have advice or your personal experience or the work that you do about how do you actually unpack that? How do you, you know, because it's beautiful how you're like, we sit around and we talk about the things we love about each other. But for a lot of us, that is so hard to hear.
Absolutely.
You know, like, yeah, obviously you know that, but it's, I just, I don't feel comfortable. And I'm like, from being 100% honest, I'm like, oh, yeah, you just don't really know me.
Yes.
You know,
so, I'm just like, there's so much beautiful vulnerability here. Thank you for sharing that. Like, I'm really curious, as you're talking about that, is if you were to receive, and as you're saying, I've tricked you, like, what does that mean? Do you feel like you're not worthy of being acknowledged or receiving that?
I've been told most of my life that I won't amount to anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, but kicked out of high school.
Yeah.
Told you won't finish school.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I've been told that by, I was even doing a talk where I grew up, like, for those people that don't know, like, down in Frankston and stuff. And I was like, this talk is like three blocks from where my high school girlfriend's mum told me that I was, didn't deserve to have the partner and that my daughter, that her daughter was too good for me. Like, you know, like that's a, I've heard that messaging everywhere along my journey. Like, you know, I've had protective elements as well, but then, yeah, I've had, without opening up too much, like, you know, conditional love from family members, violence, trauma, like, you know, classic stuff that we know that a lot of kids grow up with. And it's the biggest predictor of mental illness. And my mental illness comes from that. And so that's where it all sits for me. Like, and I, and it's not that I don't have healthy relationships around me now, but I really struggle with trust, really struggle with shame. Like, I, and I've got these three gorgeous kids, one of them, who I'm trying to think if you've met Evie, but Evie's like this beautiful, like, mini-me that's just got
I have met
mop of red hair. Yeah, yes. I was like, sure you had. Mop of red hair, and she's wild and sensitive, and she has a sensitive temperament like me. She'll always have one, and I'm like, how can I guide her better?
Yeah.
You know, like.
And thank you so much for sharing that and your vulnerability around it, because I think we all can stand in those places. And, you know, you're a person that has a profile. You, for many people, they would see you as incredibly successful. You're a doctor. You help a lot of people. You've got, you've made an impact on the world, you know, already. And yet what's so important about what you're saying is the human parts of you are still there. And I think that is so vital for all of us to know and hear that we can do all these things, it can look shiny, we can look like we've got our shit together, but we actually, those wounds that we carry from our childhood, which is so much about a lot of the work that I do, are still present. They're still there. And there is nothing like having children to mirror them back to you. I mean, on some level, you know, in your work, you see those children all the time. You can recognize that. You see parts of yourself in them. But for me, I think having our own children are these incredibly powerful mirrors of the wounds that we've got. And I often see that it is the deep invitation to lean into that, because often otherwise what we do is we often unconsciously pass that on to them, which is what no parent wants. Like, you know, you would know this. No parent wants to take their trauma and put it on their kids' shoulders and say, yeah, you can hold this for me now. I think we all have that deep desire for our children to be free, to be the most amazing version of themselves. Yet for me, parenting, yes, we are there to guide our children, but my God, they are the biggest teachers and mirrors of our own stories and stuff that we need to work with.
Yeah, it definitely is. Like, I think one of the hardest things to me has been, and I'm sure there's a healing component to it too, but there's been this like deep confusion for me of like, how could this have happened with the way that I feel about my kids, and just how I just, it's not that I think I'm a better person. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so, and also like, you know, because someone has said this to me before, like, look how successful you are because you're a doctor or because of this or because of that. But that's not how I define success. Like, I don't mean that, like, not to criticize anyone who is a doctor or, but I've done that really purposely so that I can be as skilled as I possibly can to catch little Billy and change the story. But my definition of success is healthy self-esteem and healthy relationships. Yeah. And I can hold that with my amazing partner, Annalise, and my gorgeous three kids and people like Nick, who I do the podcast with. But I really struggle to trust beyond that and take that risk. And so that's what, you know, that would be my ideal version of success. Because I also, the hardest thing for me is that I sit with the evidence and know that it's not the scripts that I write or the diagnoses I give, it's the relationships that I'm able to put resources towards and emphasize to the kids I meet in clinic. And so my little kids are growing up with no real family. Like, Annalise's family are two states away. And so Nick, who I do pop culture parenting with, he is my kid's family, you know. So this is the bit that I struggle with, is like, I can protect myself and shelter myself from the risk, but then I potentially harm my kids, you know, about how do I take the risk. And also, as you know, they're watching me. You know, they're watching me be vulnerable. So I can be vulnerable in the media and say, like, I'm emotional, I struggle and I feel like I'm not worthy and all that stuff. But in the real world, I really struggle to take chances with relationships. I just, if something goes slightly wrong, it's my fault. I abandon it. I shut down. But the problem is, I've got three kids that are watching me go, that's how you navigate relationships.
Yeah. And I want to really just acknowledge in you, Billy, you know, I often say to the people I work with, I mean, our first step is being able to identify it always, to go, yeah, there's my story. That's the story I carry. It makes sense why I have that story. This is what the world showed me. This was my upbringing. These are the places that I'm protecting myself in. You know, the first step is always the acknowledgement of it's being there. And then it's the courage to keep leaning into it and keep working with it to be able to transform it, you know. And I have found, I guess, in my whole parenting career, 25 years, you know, we're always coming from protection. I say this, and you would say the same thing to your patients and clients. We're always trying to keep ourselves safe. It's our fundamental thing that we have to do to protect ourselves. And we do that as adults as well. And you, what you're saying is so vital. What we need to transform these stories is the safety.
Yeah.
Because we can understand them and we can recognize them, but we need the evidence that it's safe enough for us to change. We need the evidence that it's safe enough for us to drop that guard a little bit, trust what is here, and rewrite some of those stories within it. And I think children are such fabulous mirrors of that stuff. But also, I come back to, with a lot of parents that I work with, and we look at these patterns and these stories, and they won't often change the story for themselves, but they'll do it for their children.
Mm.
You know, you actually said that in the documentary and scene, that there's a grab that they have where you basically, like, don't just do it, you know, for you, do it for your children, because it really is about, you know, they are watching, we are modeling that. And I do find sometimes with parents I work with, you know, when I say, what about your self-care, or how can we shift that for you? You know, the default is to be like, oh, I'm not that important, everybody else is. But so much of the work is coming home to ourselves and loving ourselves enough and healing those parts of ourselves, because that is the gift to our children. That is the ultimate gift.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I'm very good at, you know, emphasizing how important it is for other people, but I struggle, possibly can't do it for myself, you know, because even that idea of self-love, like, I just worry about arrogance and my ego.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I'm constantly, and you're right, it's from a safety perspective, I'm threat-seeking and, like, where's the trap I'm going to fall into?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I navigate that space really different in the real world too. Like, I'm really good, I think, it's a bit pat on the back, but I'm really good at, like, translating the science and the evidence around things like co-regulation into how I support my three kids.
Mm.
But when it comes to things like, what does healthy, secure self-esteem look like? I can help my kids, I can't help myself. Like, I just,
yeah,
you know, it's they're just old, deep wounds. And yeah, and I, you know, I kind of, yeah, I completely agree with you, but I think a lot of us sit there and go, that's actually too risky. Oh, instead I'll make peace with that's the way things are.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely hear that. And I think I also stand in the place that healing's always possible, which I'm sure that you have seen as well. But yet we need the safety, timing, all those pieces to come into play to lean into more of that. I mean, for me personally, my like come to my knees, like that moment, like I was probably, you know, I had quite safe, secure upbringing by all accounts. And, you know, I was probably very, very lucky compared to a lot of the stories that people have, but I still carried that good girl, need to prove myself, it's what everybody else thinks, all those kind of stories. And I had that story too. I can't be big because then people think I'm egotistical. It's easier to self-deprecating, keep yourself small, until I kind of went, actually, it doesn't help anyone if I just hide. And, you know, I want to be of service to people and to the world. And what I really began to realize for me, that saving grace is there's people who love me, even if it's just a small network, whether it's my husband, my kids, my best mate, my mum, who I trust their opinion to help me see if I am losing my center, you know, because that was always a fear for me. What if I am not authentic? What if I become all about this flashiness? And then my husband, have you met Mike before?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you've met Mike. He is so honest. I mean, if you want truth, you ask him. Yeah. He's like, babes, I will. He goes, I will bring you down.
Raise and boob to food turn.
Oh, yeah.
Just rolled in and he had like some food and he was just so comfortable and fancy. Yeah. Yeah. Like all these,
there's
all these gorgeous people. Like they were all trendy.
Yeah.
And he just rolled in and he was so beautiful and happy with himself.
Yeah. And I mean, he's a truth teller. I always go, if you want the truth. And so for me, I go, he will always tell me, that's too much. That's not enough. You're hiding, all that kind of stuff, which has been the safety for me, I think, to learn that I can stand in my place of loving myself enough or being seen, because the people around me who I really love and trust, where that evidence is there, will still hold me, because it's a big fear, right?
Yeah, that looks 100% agree, and I completely agree with you about the healing component. The hard thing is my story and lots of people's story is those people have harmed you.
Yeah.
And they have said, actually, you're right, you are inferior. And I am going to cut ties with you because love was conditional. And like that makes it like when in your sanctuary and when your figures that are meant to protect you and guide you don't do that, it means that it's very hard to then be like, well, I'll trust that again.
Yeah.
And I think that's, which has been a really long journey for me, but, and you know, and I do, you're right, because I just adore Annalise and 100% trust her and, you know, want to spend the rest of my life with her and fall more in love with her every day. But that's kind of beyond that, it's really hard for me because I'm like, it's almost like when you have your fears realized and you go, oh, man, the people that are meant to like unconditionally love you, then don't.
Yeah.
It's like, far out, that's a tough thing.
Yeah.
And I same as you, like I meet kids in clinic every single day pretty much that have worse trauma than I do.
Yes.
Like I had this beautiful moment last week with a 17-year-old who's been in residential care for 10 years.
Wow.
And his mum's trying really hard to figure out how to support him. And like, not a word of a lie, best thing that's probably happened to me clinically all year is that I've known him for about 18 months. He's a really violent, he's witnessed horrific trauma growing up from his dad, and him and I just like, I cried with him for 20 minutes just in the room. His mum was trying to help him and hug him and stuff, and he said, you know, to leave the room. And him and I just sat there and like, but you know, like he will heal, like I, you know, and I'll be a tiny part of that, but I just, yeah, it was beautiful. It was like this profound thing that is happens to me so often in clinic, where I'm just with this kid that no one wanted to see and everyone had given up on. And then just really slowly gets to the point where, yeah, we just sit there and like he was sobbing, you know, and it's just, yeah, because everything he'd been told was like that he's never going to be capable of empathy, that he was all this stuff. And I just like aggressively challenged it. Do you know what I mean? Like I was sitting there with him, and I'm just like, what a cool thing that I, you know, like I wish people could experience that.
I absolutely understand what you're talking about, and I really want to acknowledge in you, Billy, your lived experience and how important you know safety is for someone to open up in that way. And not everyone can do that. And even though I really hear your pain and the protection that sits there, it is also part of your extraordinary gift of what you do with humans, because I feel, and how I experience you is, you can sit with someone and there's no judgment. You only see the human in front of you that may have had their trauma, may have had their pain. And what I experience in you is you're like, we're all doing the best we can.
Totally. But I would also challenge that, because I see people not picking after their dog and I'm judgmental. Or I'm like,
we're all judging. We've all got a judgmental part.
But I can't even accept the compliment of like, you don't judge people. I'm like, I judge people all the time.
Well, okay, let me reframe that. When someone's in their deep wound, you are like, I see you, right? Pick up your dog shit.
Yeah. It's funny because even that, like I have a single problem with aggressive men, and it's just against my childhood.
Yeah, yeah.
I get so triggered by aggressive men.
Yeah.
It brings this final thing out of me.
Yeah.
And you're right, it comes from safety.
Yeah.
But for me, I almost lose control. I'm just like, I need to get into mode now where I protect.
Yes.
And I'd love to be that person that never judges anyone. Mm. Just see everyone's trying to do their best. And I can do it in clinic, and I get every single kid I've ever met. Yeah. I hear some awful stories. Yes. And I'm like, you're a kid.
Yeah. And I think that's what I love about you so much. And I think we all judge. And people who said they don't judge, I think are lying, right? Because I think we all do. There's parts we do. Like, and I try to be deeply compassionate for the human experience, because probably like you, I've heard thousands of stories. And I know that when we sit down and hear someone's story, you wouldn't judge, because you'd be like, if I was in your shoes, I would probably do exactly the same thing, right? So I think that's the human experience that we have. And it is easier to, when somebody's in their pain, to be able to identify that and see their story. But I think what I love about you and your work, and where I feel I stand really aligned with you, is so much around children are just responding often to their environment. They have the trauma on board of what may have happened to them. They are doing the best they can. And I get really protective when I hear people talk about kids being bad or naughty kids. I'm like, there is no such thing as a naughty kid. There is just children that are having a hard time, are trying to get their needs met, you know, are responding to their environments in the best way they can. And that has felt like it's always been a massive part of my work, is like you, to speak for the kids, to be like, no. This is what we need to understand. And, you know, a lot of my work has been helping adults to understand their triggers, what is activated in them, you know, why they get fired up with their kids. And you know, I know that you do some of that as well, but your beautiful work is helping adults to understand children developmentally, why they do what they do. And yet there's this really tricky thing, right? Because we can understand it. We can understand our own triggers, but then we still react, right? And we still respond in ways that we know are not helpful. And, you know, what have you seen over all these years of doing this work? I mean, because again, if it was just, oh yeah, I've got the information, I understand why they're doing it, oh yeah, I can see where my own triggers are, it was as simple as that, we wouldn't probably have to work, right? We'd be fine.
Yeah.
But it's not, because those activations run deep, we get triggered, we know when we're tired, we're less responsive, or we're less patient, all those kind of things. Like, in all your years of experience, like how do we navigate those two places?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I also, I think I have a primary role in the clinical work I do in the broader advocacy of helping people understand the kid and what their experience. I agree, like, there's no bad kids. And, you know, even what's happening in some communities at the moment, which is not a new thing, of like kids breaking into houses and stealing cars, I'm like, there's a reason. And I meet all those kids. And for years and years and years, they sent up hundreds of flares that they were struggling, and we kind of came in with punitive measures or locked them up earlier, despite the fact it's shown to make it worse. And yeah, there's an opportunity for us to do better if we actually understand what the needs of those kids are, from simple things like you're saying around safety, sense of belonging, connection, purpose, seeing themselves and others, participating in cultural traditions. Like, all this stuff is what fosters a sense of, you know, secure self-esteem and confidence in relationships, resolving conflict, all that stuff, the skills that they need that often kids miss out on. And so I think I have that role, but I also think I do a lot of work with parents in validating their experience, because I think the biggest predictor of how you will parent is how you were parented. And some of the most heroic parents I've ever met are ones that have broken multi-generational cycles of trauma, including parents that have had their kids taken away from them. So I meet them, you know, like, I had to do supervised visitations as a kid. I went through the family courts. Like, you know, and this is the problem, is that there's no, like, bad, like, neither of my parents finished high school, both had their own trauma and mental illness, like really severe mental illness. And, you know, they were, as you said, doing their best. And it doesn't mean harm doesn't happen, but it also doesn't mean that they're evil. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the work I do is trying to build the capacity of the parents to understand where what's coming from the kid, but also what's in their behavior and thinking. And I even remember, I can't remember if I've told this story, I think I told a version of it on Pop Culture Parenting, but I remember a dad, and it was like the end of a day. I'd seen my 12 kids already that day, and I was pretty exhausted, and the last family cancelled, and I was like, sweet, I'll get to see my kids earlier. I just had two then. And I was like, I'll get to see my kids earlier. And the amazing people that run the admin at the hospital workout were like, Billy, we've slotted a family in. They've been waiting 2 years, but they're driving from hours away, and they're really desperate. And the 8-year old can't go to school until you see them.
Mm.
Like, what am I doing? One appointment that, like, this kid's suddenly going to be safe
Fine.
In school. Mm. You know, exactly. Mm. I was like, okay. And for me, 100%, I was annoyed. I was like, all right. And his mum rolled in, who just had a really tough life. She had 4 kids, a little baby in her arms. The 8-year old was the oldest, and 2 in between. And this huge hulk of a man came in, and he was the dad of the baby, but all the boys had different dads.
Yeah.
And the 8-year-old's kicking off, externalizing behavior, heaps of trouble. And it always happens. They come in and they just want to tell me all the bad stuff. And kid just sits there, which still blows my mind all these years later, just hearing this narrative. And I understand that parents need to tell me this bit. And they've been hearing a lot from, you know, schools that are doing their best to support these kids, but just aren't supported well enough. Anyway, could not connect with the dad. I'm like, you know, do you... how are you going with this? What do you think? Didn't say a single word to me. And these kids having a lot of behavioral problems at home as well, like really struggling. And right at the end, dad realized that it was finishing up. And he's like, I've got a question for you. Standing there, his arms crossed, refused to sit down. And he's like, I'm like, great, awesome. He's going to ask me something. And he goes, how come when I hit him, he points to the 8-year-old, he said he cowers anytime I come in the room for days after it. But he genuinely didn't understand. He was, he wasn't like, you know, he really didn't understand. Now, there's a mandatory reporting component of that, but there's also this beautiful component of, like, my opportunity then to change the world that kid lives in.
Yes.
Because that dad had been brought up like that.
Yes.
You know, we still know there's a huge percentage of families that use physical discipline in Australia, internationally, despite the fact that makes emotional labor difficulties worse. It worsens mental health of parents because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
No one's taught them.
Yeah.
Like, you just have a kid and then it's like, good luck, you know, and this she'll be right attitude is wrong. Like, I mean, this golden era that we supposedly grew up in where merely half of us had mental illness is ridiculous. So my whole thing is, like, I'm very lucky to have a lot of training and research and experience. But I've learned the most off the thousands of kids I've met over 25 years now. Like, and how can I share that to change the world that kid lives in, our future? You know, I've got 2 girls, but the risk of intimate partner violence is 25%. That is wild. The, you know, the negative beliefs that a lot of men have about women are objects, you know, 25% of Australian men identify with that stuff.
Yeah.
On recent data, they were little boys that were not destined to those beliefs.
Yes.
That was not set in stone, and we need to do a better job of making our communities safer, going back to your point about how we bring kids up with love and compassion and also boundaries, consequences, all that stuff. This is not like a just love them and that'll be enough. Mm-hmm. It's about how do we give them the skill set to navigate this stuff.
And yes.
That's the really cool thing. I get to do it one at a time after a 3-year wait in with a tiny group of kids that come and meet us at clinic. They're through the fellows that we train or the kids that I get to see. But there's got to be a better way to do this than parents just being lost. And they're all trying their hardest. All parents that I meet that have their kids taken off them, they're just holding more weight than I am with less resource.
And I really do believe all parents, they become parents and they want to love and care and they want the best for their children. Nobody goes into parenting going, wow, I'm going to mess up their life or make it tricky. Of course they don't. We all come in that way. Yet the impact of the trauma and the experience we've had, the way we were raised, it's massive. And yet I'm such an optimist, but I also sit in hope that we are at a time where we have access to information, we have access to research, we have access to people who share information in ways that it can reach people, even if it's not reaching the people who probably need it. But I see the needle moving just a little bit around what our parents or our grandparents had as far as information and understanding. We are at a time right now which I think is really tough being a parent because we understand that there's a different way to do it, but part of that involves us reparenting ourselves on some level and healing our stuff. So we change the behaviors and the ways that we respond to our children so that we start to heal some of that big intergenerational trauma and we start to see it shift and change. But it is not easy. It's hard. It's, you know, it's even as you're saying, even with your own personal story, you understand it, you have resources, you say you go to a therapist, you have all the tools there, yet it still feels big because those wounds run deep and because again, as you say, when you have enough evidence over time that tells you one thing, that's what we believe to be true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where my heart just moves into so much compassion for parents and our ability to try and make this change requires so much courage. I mean, I'm curious to know, what did you say to that dad?
Yeah, the first thing I said to him is you can't go near him when you feel like this. And I taught him how to self-regulate. And then I taught him how to co-regulate that kid, how to guide him towards what he wanted him doing and how full the relationship he had with him was.
Yeah.
He explained why he was anxious. He kind of got anxiety.
Yeah.
Like if you have to guess why a kid is angry and acting out, they've clinical anxiety. It's like the most common reason. No one thinks it's a feature of anxiety, but it is. So I taught him that. I built a bond with the dad. I built a partnership with him. I have training and work in a framework called relation practice, which is all about how do we share power. Like I don't sit in the space of like I'm an expert that says, how does that make you feel? I say that must be really hard.
Yes.
And I share my own story and use self-disclosure clinically and like all of that stuff. And so I taught him that and we walked through that stuff together over multiple appointments. It wasn't like, here's the solution, see ya. But yeah, I put all my efforts into protective factors in that little boy's life, build mum's capacity, get support around her, drop the demands, you know, support to the school like we do with my PhDs and school stuff. And like it was all about how do I build the capacity of these educators to identify and support these kids. Understand where the evidence sits in a practical way, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's a really cool thing. And I think there's one thing which is hard, but I feel safe enough talking to you because of how wise you are in this space of like sometimes when I said in the media, every parent is trying their hardest, people will say, no, the things my parent did to me, and they will be really hurt by hearing me say that. Yes. And so that's one thing that I try really hard to acknowledge is that, you know, even my own experience, but, you know, there are parents out there that have, you know, for lots of different reasons and not because they're bad people, but have done stuff that is very difficult to repair in what's happened to their kids. And there's a lot of adults now that are just carrying that trauma.
Yep.
And I actually started working in mental health in adult psychiatry. And I even talked about this in the book, I think, where I was like, I was heartbroken because I was like, because people were getting discharged from a psych ward and it wasn't, you'll never be back. It was like, let's see how long you can last until you need to come back. And I remember being like, surely that's not true. Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, 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 they will come back.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, oh my God, that's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But then I've been on the psych ward for kids and it's not the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that the role that I have, because I was doing child psychiatry stuff, is as a developmental pediatrician, I can meet them earlier.
Yes.
You know, and I have a different lens of not what's the diagnosis. I think about what's going on for this kid.
Yes.
And what can I do that's modifiable to change their story and their trajectory and all that stuff. So it's, you know, there's a lot of hope for me in childhood, mm-hmm. but I don't have adult mental health expertise, which I think is where a lot of my phones are. Mm-hmm. It's how do I guide myself through that, mm-hmm. you know? And so, mm-hmm. yeah, but it's, and I'm, you know, I think it's really challenging, but I think so many of us that work in this space are here because of our own experience and mm-hmm. trying to change things for other people. Mm-hmm. The beautiful kind of healing component there is to that about, but I'm sure you had this same thing where I'm like, I'm sacrificing time with my kids to do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, how do I avoid them mm-hmm. back and going?
Mm-hmm. Dad was saving the world, but wasn't home with us.
The podcast instead of actually being this. Yeah. I firmly believe it's what I do with my kids, not how much time I spend with them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I know we've had some conversations about this, haven't we? Because, like, you know, my kids are old now and I feel like I've come through the tricky part. I mean, you've got little people, mate. Like, I'm just like, you need to nap for a week.
Did I say the 3 months old, 2 years old, 4 years?
Yeah. Dude, you are in the trenches, right, with them. I mean, I was just saying to someone on another podcast before, I'm in this weird space where I actually don't have to parent anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, all my three kids are at home, but they're adults. They're doing their own thing. They drive to places. Usually it's just like, mom, can I have some money? Like, you know, it's that, or I'm like, are you home for dinner? But I am not needed in that way anymore, which is a strange part of my life, because there's actually all this space now, right? But I think, you know, the years where my kids were young, I was home with them a lot of time. I still had business, most kind of business stuff on the side. But Mike and I decided, okay, I want to be there with the kids as much as we can. So we were a one income family and it was hard. Like, it was really stressful financially. And I think we're only still catching up to that now. But that's what we decided to do, and I don't regret any of that space. But it was still super challenging. There were so many times where, and I say this to mothers all the time, I was so bored. I'm like, I feel like I'm a shell of a person because I don't really have purpose. All I'm doing is the same thing day in, day out. Like, parenting is hard.
Oh,
it is so hard. And I think, you know, it is trying to find the balance. And what I had to really work through, because for the first 8 years of being a mum, I hated being a mum. Like, I had no self-care. I didn't know how to have boundaries. I was a super permissive mum. I mean, if you had met me, you would have been like, there needs to be some boundaries here. But I often say this, I really believe that if my kids were happy, it meant I was doing a good job. Mm. So I just tried to get them happy all the time, which we know doesn't work, right? And all it does is make you super exhausted. So I was resentful. I was so resentful towards Mike. He got to go to work. He got to go and have a coffee. I couldn't even go to the toilet on my own. So I was a really grumpy, unhappy mum, because and part of my healing was having a third baby, going through trauma, having massive PTSD with myself. That's what kind of brought me to my knees, where it's what actually got me into doing this work, because I went from being someone who was, you know, I was working in birth, I was a child birth educator, I was teaching, I was doing all these things, to actually, I couldn't even really get my kids to school. Like, I would have just panic attacks. I was full of anxiety. And that was my moment for me, where I was like, this shit, you have to heal. And what it was is that PTSD was actually just the catalyst for, you know, being a good girl most of my life, keeping everyone else happy, taking on the book burden of everyone. The role I played in my family was to emotionally make sure everybody was okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm a really sensitive human. I always feel people. I'm like, it's why I have a lot of compassion, because I'm like, I can feel exactly what's going on for someone. That was my role in my family. Even though my family was pretty safe, I was the emotional barometer of the family. And my belief system was, I got to keep everyone happy. So then I became a mum, carried the same thing. And then, you know, my trauma had to happen to, I think, bring me to my knees to go, you're allowed to be vulnerable. Your job is not to fix everybody else. Where are your boundaries? Where are your needs? All that kind of stuff. And it was messy. And I massively unraveled for quite a few years. And I tried all the things to fix myself. I was doing this modality and that, and I was doing it all until I began to kind of realize, you know, a lot of it was about that self-love. It was about having boundaries. It was about really looking at where I had come from, what I had been imprinted, what I wanted, and really looking at my children going, who do I want them to be in the world? Well, they're watching me. So the invitation was to dive deeper, and it was not easy. And yet also I was coming from a place that so many people don't have, which is I still had a loving family. I had money to access support if I needed to. I realized my privilege within it, but it was still freaking hard. And then I look at other people and I realize, you know, they are so far behind the eight ball of even just accessing this support, these resources, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think that has fueled me to want to help others, much like you. It has really fueled me to hold a place of safety for children, but also to help adults understand that we can do the work, even if it takes time. And it's, I don't think anyone ever regrets doing the work and regrets looking at their stuff and healing, because we see the effects of where it rolls onto next within it. But it's big. It's really, really big work. And I think, as I was saying before, we're at this time in history where it's so much more available to us. We're actually saying the word trauma. We never used to say the word trauma. We never used to say the word vulnerability. We never used to say any of these things. But now they are becoming part of our narrative that we're slowly starting to see. Now, I don't see a lot of the people that you see, you know, in my work, because I often see people who do have access to money and resources and stuff like that, and they come to do some healing work. And I often sit there and think, how do we reach more people? How do we help everybody hear this? You know, and I don't know what the answer is. And even I look at that from an education point of view, that I created my own school because I was like, could we do this in a different way to help children feel seen and heard and have spaces where they can cry and not be told off, where it's okay to be angry. Let's help you move the anger in a healthy way. Can we create a space of learning where children have different ways that they learn, and that is cherished and accepted and championed within them? You know, like I thought creating my school would be the answer, but I know it's not, because it doesn't suit all kids. It's one little step. And sometimes I feel, which I can imagine you do too, that, yeah, I'm trying to do all this stuff and it doesn't feel enough sometimes.
Definitely. And there's one thing you said, like this beautiful thing you said, just that you were talking about then, but right at the start about, yeah, we don't, there's like this really superficial tokenistic acknowledgement of stay-at-home parents. Mm. But like Annalise and I often talk about this, because Annalise does like 84-hour weeks, like 14-hour days. She's an obstetrics doc, but she loves what she does, just like me. And so we have this challenge of like the best versions of ourselves are ones where we are doing all those things, but we also would probably not be good, even me as a so-called expert, at being there
all the time,
12 hours a day, right, playing with them. Like, you know, I would burn out and I'd struggle with it. And, you know, I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge, because I don't think we talk enough about how hard it must be and even lonely it must be to sometimes be that parent who's always supporting a child.
Yeah.
And like, educators are the most important professionals in the world, but they do your stuff too. Like, they're spending more time with these kids at school ages than parents are in a day of waking hours and navigating social conflict and blah, blah. But yeah, there's also this bit. I wonder for you, one thing that I really struggle with is what the world will be like for my kids. And like, I think that's a big motivator for me, like obviously the intimate partner violence stuff, but just a broader understanding of how do we create emotional safety, what do respectful relationships look like, you know. And I also wonder for you, was there any time where you saw your vulnerability in like being the one that had to keep everyone happy? You ever seen that in your kids and worried? Because I guess that's for me, that's what I'm
reading. What's the evidence? Yeah.
Because I'm like, how do I make sure Evie, this sensitive wild breakhead, doesn't fall in the same traps that I have?
Yeah. Two things there. You asked that question just before, and then I went off on a tangent, and my menopause brain went, what were we actually talking about? So I'm going to circle back just for a minute and go, yes, what I was trying to say just earlier on was that part of the quantity of the time we spend versus the quality of the time. Like, you know, we've talked about that and stuff before too. And I often say to parents, we can spend 12 days with our kids and be completely not present with them, and they feel that, you know, at the invitation with our children is to be present.
Because you had a New Zealand, didn't you, where you were like, you guys.
Oh, we had spent 3 weeks in New Zealand, the five of us together. I mean, they were adults. It was intense, man. And we thought it would be a good idea to get a camper van and all five of us live in it for 4 days. My God, the stuff that came up for everyone. And blessings to emotional intelligence, because my children are very emotionally intelligent. We sat down, we had open conversations. This is not working. You fart too much. You snore when you sleep. It was really bonding, but it was also, it was big.
Well, that's really important for people to hear, because there's so much on social media. It's like, it was the best age of our life.
Do you know the most engagement I ever get on my social media is when I talk about where I've messed up as a parent? Mm-hmm. It's the most engagement I get. Or I run this mentorship, this 8-month mentorship, and the people in my mentorship wanted to hear from my children because, you know, they want to see evidence that what you're talking about is kind of true. And not that my kids are the gold standard. They're not, because they're human and, you know, they've got this. Everyone, there's no perfect, right? But my kids got on, my two girls got on the mentorship, and these people just asked some questions and they absolutely loved it. And my kids are like, yeah, one time mum did this and then the other one they did this. And I'm like sitting there going, I mean, the people in the mentorship were laughing and they were saying though, oh my God, this gives me permission to not have to be perfect. I'm like, there's no perfect. I feel like I could sit down and just tell you all the ways that I've messed up to make you feel better, that there's no perfection in that, right? And I think when we have to look at the bigger, greater balance here of, I agree with you, I think it's important if we have purpose and stuff that we love, that we fuel that. We are also a person, not just a parent, you know. We are a lover or a husband or a wife. We have to nourish that as well. There's so many aspects to it that I think we have to give our time to. And being a parent full-time for me is one of the hardest jobs you will ever do. I used to say working is easy, getting to work is hard, right? Because it's all the things that you take in order to do that. And I think it looks different for everybody. And what I would love is if we let go of all the judgment around it, because people are like, we should do this, we should do that. I think we actually all have to look at our family circumstances and go, how do our kids get the best out of us, right? That's what I look at. And coming back to what you were just saying before about, you know, how are our kids going to be in the world? I feel like I'm in this really beautiful position now where my children are adults and all three of my kids work with children. Or the middle one, not anymore, but they have all worked with children. And it has been one of my biggest missions in raising my kids is to help them develop that emotional intelligence muscle. So talking about feelings, welcoming their tears and their anger, teaching them really healthy ways to process that, creating a lot of quiet for listening. Like the number one thing I always say as a parent is we have to master the art of listening. Listening without fixing, listening without judging, listening without getting into the drama with them, but just being that safety, much like you did for that beautiful 17-year-old boy in your space who could just cry, so that they feel I can bring all of myself to you. So my mission as a parent was always, I want my children to be the most fully expressed version of themselves. I want them to know that they are free to be who they need to be. And in order to do that, I have to watch my expectations. I have to watch my judgments. I'm there to guide them, but I want them to be them, because I think what I have learned in my work over the years, so much of the pain points that people come to when they get down to those wounds are, am I enough? Right? Because of the conditioning of you're only lovable when you're good, or the messaging like you received of you're not good enough, you never amount to anything. So the core wound for most adults, I think, is, am I enough? Like, am I lovable just the way I am? So I've always had that in the back of my head is of, I want my kids to know that they are lovable just the way they are. And you know what's funny is, I mean, poor kids, I've probably indoctrinated into them so much, is they now do this thing where they're leaving to go out and I'm like, okay, I love you. And they go, yeah, I know I'm enough. I know I'm lovable. they do this like eye roll almost of just say, yeah, I got it. Yep. If it's a, you know, tune in with myself, I've got it, mum, make it, you know, like it's so funny because they've heard it so many times.
Yeah.
They kind of roll their eyes with it, which is beautiful, because I'm like, if that's the annoying voice in your head, then I've done a good job, right?
Yeah.
Of them going, I am enough who I am, right? And so I think what I have seen now being in this beautiful place of being a parent, and I definitely have not got it all right, like we've messed up in all the ways, But what I have seen is as we keep doing this work, as I keep doing my work, Mike's done, you know, his own work in his own way, and we keep holding this beautiful sense of connection and emotional intelligence at the center of what we want for our kids, they have grown up to be humans who not only that's innate in them, that when, you know, when they work with kids and a child's upset, the first thing they do is get down low, and they are so calm in their regulation. They don't even have to work at it. The words they say are like, you know, a natural language for them. They have no judgment, you know, and both my kids work with children that are neurodiverse, right? So, you know, there's a lot of big feelings and stuff that go on, and their ability to have deep acceptance of them, it's like it's embodied. And I see that sometimes a lot of adults have to work at that, but it's like they know it because that's the language they grew up with. And that's where I see and where I have hope, because I think if we can keep doing this powerful work, we bring it into education, we keep helping to heal the adults, we keep talking about it, we keep making it part of our, you know, vernacular, the narrative that we keep talking about being human, then it becomes something that is innate to them. And that's where I have hope that we will start to shift this. Because we are at a bit of a crisis point, you would agree, right? We see what's happening with kids in school, we see mental health issues, we see anxiety at an all-time high. I mean, the difference even in 10 years, right, 20 years ago to where we are now, like it's huge. You can see everyone's seeing it. Anyone who works in education is like, whoa, what is going on here? And yet I still stand in this place of like we're at a tipping point and we have to do better. And how do we do that? Well, there's many – I don't have the exact answer, but I think there's many ways that we can contribute to help doing that. And I think the work in the family home is always for me. If we can – we can start right from the very beginning supporting parents early, from the moment they're pregnant to birth experiences to those postpartum years to all of that. How do we bring more support, more education, more understanding? Then maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to shift it a little bit.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And it's interesting because, yeah, I'm a bit similar to you that Evie now, like, I'll say, honest, tell you something. She's like, yeah, I know you love me. And, like, she was sitting there with that. I was walking back from the playground with her and I did it. And she's like, you know, it kind of annoys you when you do that. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry, gorgeous. Do you want me to stop doing it? And you could see her processing it. And she's like, you can do it sometimes.
Yeah.
It's important that I wasn't having her think she has to do it. Yep. There's also this beautiful thing that you can sense in your kids. Like I've met your middle child, but also just in the story you tell about them being open to speak to people and say, you know, Mum did this. And you're the same, like you would know this, probably don't feel comfortable saying it on the mics, but a lot of people in their mental health space are not how they are in the media. Yeah. Whereas you're this beautiful, you know, honest, supporting human that's the same, which is cool and why I'm such a big fan of yours. But is the thing about like saying sorry to our kids and like that idea that a kid who can say Mum stuffed up, tell people is a kid that feels really safe.
100%.
Like, I think a lot of us grew up without parents, like even regardless of trauma, but parents that didn't say sorry couldn't have been able to say, hey, this is my fault.
Yeah.
And kids who have a big emotional expressions and can challenge what we're saying and stuff, that's actually a sign of a safe relationship.
100%.
Whereas the most vulnerable thing that you can do with a kid is make love conditional on how you perform for me and whether you're compliant.
Yeah.
And one of the worst things we see in clinic, and it's a lot of parents who, just because they grew up with that, is withdrawing love when you don't do what I say.
Absolutely. And that to me is, again, I 100% agree with you, that behaviorism paradigm that we've grown up in. I love you when you're good, take something away from you when you're bad. I mean, to me what it does is it fosters the good girl, good boy narrative that most of us have been raised with. So then we get to being adults and they come and see me and they're still outsourcing their love. Like, am I pretty enough? Am I smart enough? Am I making enough money? The enoughness is all still conditional because that's what has been the imprint for so many years around I approve of you or I will give you my energy or my love when you are compliant or when you do what I approve of. And I mean, and I say this to educators all the time when I talk to them, the goal is not to raise good boys and good girls. Mm. It is not to raise compliant children, because compliant children exactly won't push back, won't say how they think, won't, you know, what they're doing is they're basically having to abandon themselves in order just to belong or to survive. And we don't actually want that. Mm. We want children to be connected to the truth of who they are. Yet that is confronting in a three-year-old. That's the hardest part, right? We want our children to have a voice. We want them to be able to have a strong no. We want them to be able to go, that doesn't look okay, I'm going to say something. But in a three-year-old body, that's so challenging. That is so challenging.
But it's interesting about your journey, you know, then had this big turning point and you kind of have had this reflection and you've probably worked so much on repair with all of your kids and yourself and your partner.
Yeah.
That the payoff is this really interesting one that probably we don't realize we're aiming for, is when you can sit in a caravan and you can all talk about how these are the annoying things. And if they're coming back to you, that's actually a really good sign that your kids are like, and you know what you do that's really frustrating, Mom? It's like, split. We're all safe.
Yeah.
We're all choosing to be
here. Huge.
And we're all like being really comfortable in being honest with each other.
Yeah.
Like, what beautiful relationships that you've obviously done so much work.
Yeah. And I would say, like, my children are my greatest work, without doubt. Like, I've done some really good things in the world, but I'm, like, raising them and having to do the messy stuff for myself has been the greatest gift of my life. And so if I was to die tomorrow, I don't want to, but I would be at peace, because I feel like having the absolute privilege and honor to raise them and to hopefully give them a really safe foundation to be in the world is, to me, is the ultimate. And, you know, when you talk about that, the safety to push back, there's many pivotal moments in my parenting career, but there is one huge foundational moment that was such that switch between punitive, making my kids wrong, and owning stuff. And I so clearly remember it. And I talk about this because I think people go, whoa, it stops them in their tracks. I reckon my son was about 14, 15. So the teen years as a whole, I said to parents, like, give me a raging three-year-old any day. Teenagers, I'm like, oof. There's a whole new parenting skill set that happens when you have teens, right? But I remember, and the stories I tell about my kids, I often always say this, and I haven't said this yet on the podcast. The stories I tell about my kids, they've given me permission to tell, but there's some things that have happened over the years. They're like, do not use that in a workshop. They're like, that's a great teachable, right? But they're like, you can't use that one. So the stories I tell, they've given me permission to tell. But this one time, my son, 14, 15, he's like, I'm going to go stay at Charlie's house. Charlie's doing that. I'm going to go stay at Kai's house. They're in another house, right? So they're doing the whole, we all did that, right? And so Mike and I cotton onto the fact that he's actually not where he says he is, right? And so we're like, oh, he's somewhere else. And we could see that he was somewhere else. So we message him to kind of give him the option as an out. How are you going at Charlie's? He's like, yeah, great, just playing PlayStation or something like that. And we're like, well, he's committing to the lie, okay? Give him props for that. And then we gave him a little bit more time, and then we actually rang him and we said, we know that you're not where you say you are. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and I'm like, we're going to come pick you up, right? Because Charlie, his parents thought he was at our house. So we go and pick up the two boys. And Kai tells me later that Charlie's like, oh, my God, are we going to be in trouble? And Kai's like, nah, they're just going to talk to us. He knew straight away that we're like, fuck, we're going to have to sit down and listen and talk about the feelings.
Just like the punishment.
Yeah, probably. Like, can you just ground me or something? So anyway, now the interesting thing, there's two parts of this story that I really reveal. I was angry. Like, I was pissed off because I'm like, I worked so hard on relationship and honesty, and like, I was angry, and I knew enough to know that was not the space I need to talk to him in. So I had to be angry. Mike and I were having a rant, and I was like saying, what are you pissed off about? What am I pissed off about? And we both were basically, we were just having to vent first before we spoke to him. So then he gets home, and that's a big thing. Calm down first. Let's let all the dust settle first before we have a conversation. So then I go into his room, and I sat there and I took a breath and I said to him, buddy, I am so sorry if I have not made it safe enough for you to tell me the truth. That is on me. And he just looked at me like this. And you know I value truth and you value honesty. So there must be something where I haven't made it safe enough for you. And he looks at me and he goes, Mum, we're at a girl's house and you get so excited when I talk about girls. I just couldn't deal with it. So I'm like, oh, okay. Now, in my great need to try and make it really open for all my kids to talk about boyfriends, girlfriends, sex, all that kind of stuff, you know, I really wanted it to be really open and we have all these conversations. I'd probably gone too far. I mean, I taught sex ed to teenagers for 5 years. I taught all my kids' friends. Like, how bad's that? How much are you going to need therapy if your mum is the one that comes into year 9 science class and talks about all the stuff?
Your kids?
Pardon?
It'd be hard.
Oh, they dated, I don't know. And I mean, again, my kids were like, Mom, why were you like the sex ed teacher? Right? I'm like, there's therapy just there, right? Anyway, so in Kai's, you know, innocence, he's like, he's quite a private person. And he was just like, you just get really excited. And it was true because I'd be like, oh, who's the girl? What are you doing? And in my attempt to try and make it, I was going too far. And so he's just like pulling it back. So again, I would never have known that. And in that moment when he's honest enough to say, we went to a girl's house and you would just get all up in my business about it, so that's why I didn't tell you. And I was like, got it. And I said, mate, I absolutely hear that. I respect that. And I go, I will pull back on that. But what's so important for Dad and I is that we know where you are. Like, that's one of our big values here. Like, we give you lots of room to explore, but safety is really important for us. And he goes, great. And then that was it. We both learnt, I need to pull back on this. And that was the last time he ever lied about where he was, right? Now, I always tell that story because I'm like, that could have gone so differently. Mm-hmm. If I had come in hot, I'm going to take your phone off you, you're going to be grounded, like all that kind of stuff, we would have missed this extraordinary opportunity there for both learning together, for connection as a parent and as a child. But also, you know, the big part of that was, firstly, I had to own all my rage, firstly, to clear that. But secondly, I'm like, I had to take responsibility to go, I am part of this relationship as well. Where are we not making it safe enough, you know? And I know that kids, and you know this, like kids all have little lies they tell, right? Because it's protective. And we sometimes, especially in those teenage years, they're like, I need to figure out who I am outside of you. So I knew that. I knew that there were going to be things, but I was not expecting my kids to always tell me the truth, but I was like, when it counts, we need to know, right? And that's what I really prioritized. And I think for me, that being able to repair, say, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. I mean, in that's not a classic kind of repair moment, but it's a really important story because I think it really, for me, highlights that we have to own our place in this dynamic as well, because we can often just make our kids wrong.
Yeah, and what an amazing thing that you're able to either consciously choose, I need to get this heat out of me first, or if you were just in such a great healthy relationship, because the guy that cuts my hair is like, I reckon hairdressers deliver more mental health.
They do. They are therapists.
Yeah. I've got this great like guys, you know, his kids are adults now and he talks about this stuff, but he was a single father. Mm. He just talks about how hard it was because he's like, I have to be the bad cop and the good cop. Mm. And he was like, just talking about that. And you kind of think about, yeah, and he's done this beautiful job as well. He's just this great guy that I talk to whenever I'm about to do some media. I often go and get this haircut and I'm like, I've got to look slightly less to show me. I get like this therapy of just talking to him about like stuff because he's been in this space for decades and like has had to deal with all of the kind of attitudes about an like hairdresser and all this stuff. But it's really cool. And I think that ability to even just reflect. And there's this really cool thing about as well that you've obviously done though with your kids about we are together in this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a cool, even I did something recently with Tanya Payne Bryson, and she talks about, you haven't broken my trust, you just bent it.
Yeah.
And now we have to figure out together how we get back to succeeding and what matters to us and our values, as opposed to these rigid rules that like you didn't tell me where you
were. Yeah.
And like how do we teach kids that the relationship trumps everything is a really beautiful thing.
I agree totally. And one of the lines I used to say is, what have we both learned from this? So when there was ruptures, when something was off, once it had calmed down, once there'd been repair, I was always like, what have we both learned? What are we going to do differently next time? If we were to do this over, how could we do it in a better way? And I think that helps a lot because it really kept reminding me, I am still learning as well, as are they, and how do we do this? And that's been even interesting as my kids have moved into adulthood. Your relationships shift and change and that they're still learning in that as well for me, massively. You know, even though I don't have to parent really anymore, there is still elements of being in their lives in different places and spaces that are still providing lots of growth and learning for me. It's an ongoing journey.
Yeah, and that sensitivity and responsiveness is the important bit about it. It's like, how are you going? Don't need to modify, which is a really cool thing that we should be doing with all the relationships that matter to us. But I think we're just so used to being like, I can never admit that I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Take responsibility as weakness.
Yeah. Which, again, we know. I mean, that if you look at what was modeled to you, of course, it's where so many people struggle with that.
Yeah.
Yep. Again, when we begin to see actually the evidence, because so much of it is about evidence, isn't it? When I do repair, what happens to the relationship? When I do say sorry, you know, I see the softness come in. Like, it's so much, I think, in changing these massive patterns. We have to be brave enough to give it a go and then keep looking for the evidence of how much it shifts and changes, which I'm sure you see all the time too. When parents yell a lot, when they're beginning to be able to work with their own anger, they're being able to move it in a healthy way, they begin to see the shift and change in their children. You know, I think as long as we can kind of see that dial slightly moving, just keep going, you know, because you will see the rewards of it in your relationship.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's reflective practice, and it's where the best evidence is for parenting across cultures. It's like, how am I going in this family?
Yeah.
And you know, I'm trying really hard. Is that
yes. Nice? Yes. Yeah. I love that you have all the beautiful clinical speakers. I say things and you go, yeah, that's that. And I go, oh, is that what it's called? No, it's perfect.
You spend so much time in the kind of academic journals that I'm.
But it's so.
So I wonder, I'm like, am I dry too?
No, you're not. I think what you do is you bring this beautiful, you marry what we know is that clinical evidence stuff, right, to people to make sense to them. And I think that's what your beautiful gift is. You help people see this is what the research and the science says, because so often what you say, I go, oh, yeah, and I go, oh, yeah, I'll do that. I don't know what that actually means, because I'm not really formally trained in anything. I have just lived
how am I going with this? I think that's why you've honed it so well, because you're like, how's this kid going? How am I going? Because of your own stuff. Like, I didn't know that about your journey. And that makes sense now, because you're like, no, sweet, this is not good. I want things to be better. And my job actually isn't to keep everyone happy.
Yes.
And then what is my job? And thinking about that. And it's a cool thing. Like, I see that change in so many amazing caregivers that I meet in clinic, where they shift that stuff and they often are really scared by it. But then they shift it and they go, oh, man.
Yeah.
This is like, some of the best things about the podcast is people that I've never met, right? And they'd be like, man, I've been listening for 2 weeks. So I've been listening for nearly 4 years.
Yeah.
And our dinners are so different. My own life, my relationship with my kids. And I'm just like, man, you've just been listening to me and Nick about this stuff. But I think it's just that opportunity to think about, how am I actually going in this? Because I don't need to try harder. I just need to probably do something different.
Yes. And it really makes me think about the power of storytelling, right, which is what you and Nick do really well. You tell stories, we see evidence of how that looks, and I think when people can identify themselves and see themselves in it, I think that's really powerful.
Well, I think you do that too as well. Like, it's interesting because all the evidence is out there. It's been out there for 60, 70 years about attachment, but people don't understand it.
Yes.
And then when you hear someone actually tell it in a way that relates to a story, and you can see them in it, the humility, failure and vulnerability, but then how to practically do it, they go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
That stuff's been out there. It just hasn't been truly accessible.
Yes.
So it's a really beautiful thing to see that changing, and that is something that I am hopeful about.
Yes, good. I'm glad there's some hope there. I would love to hear, as we kind of finish up, your three beautiful little humans, when they are the age my kids are now, like 25 and 22 and 17, what do you hope that they say about you and Annalise?
That's a tough one. You know, it doesn't take much for me to get emotional, but. And probably for the context of listeners, like, I had a very close relationship with my mum, and she died in her early 50s when I was in my early 20s. And, like, so I had a lot of fear around that. I had a lot of fear of, like, me being gone before they don't need me anymore. And so, like, whenever I think about that stuff, I get quite emotional because I'm like, oh, man. But I really worry about that. Like, I exercise 2 times a day, and, like, you know, I'm trying as hard as I can to make sure that I'm around, just even that bit of it. But I think it goes back to that bit about, like, I'm fairly confident that they feel safe, I just wanted to make sure that they know how much I love them and how much I celebrate them and for who they are. Like, I think that's the thing, is that I resonate with that so much, about that idea of like, kids should just be who they are. And we've got to take pressure off, like, this is how you should be. And I think that I just, I have these three gorgeous kids and I just want to, like, I'm like madly in love with my son. Like, it's this really beautiful thing about like just being affectionate to him. I really found it hard at first. Let's call him Mace and kind of dismiss him abuse. And we did like the Beautiful Boys episodes on Pop Culture Parenting because I just started calling him beautiful. And it was kind of this really powerful shift for me. Like, I can have a little boy and it's not, it's not this 90s boy thing. It's like actually him and I got really affectionate. And I think that I grew up kind of being teased for that and being locked for it. And I can see him and just be like, and he's so much like that now. Like, he was kind of, when Heidi came along, poking in and all that classic stuff, and we just kind of got dolls and like cared for them. And now he's so caring and affectionate to his little sister. And so it's like, I think that's what matters to me, is that I just like, and that they were the best part of my life. Like, I adore Annalise, but I'm like, man, I didn't know, which is really hard because of my own childhood stuff. I didn't know you could love someone as much as I love my three kids. Like, I didn't know that. And it's not that I don't find it hard and they drive me crazy sometimes, all this stuff, but I just, I just find myself thinking about them. And I'd like stress, have nightmares about something happening to me and me not being around for them and all that stuff. But I am, I just think, that's why I push back against the idea of like, you're a doctor and all of this stuff. I'm like, I'm like three jobs. Like, I never saw her, she was really struggling all the time. And so it's interesting that I feel like I'm repeating that cycle a little bit, because I'm like so worried about like financial insecurity and like, which is ridiculous, but that's just what I grew up in. But actually what I wish is that I just had more time with my mom, and I'd had more time just enjoying her and seeing her enjoy me, because it's heartbreaking. I don't have a lot of memories like that. And so I'm trying to make sure that that happens for my kids, and just really just that they'll remember how much I adored them.
I have a absolute rule, is that you never apologize for crying.
I know, it's funny. Someone wrote into the podcast about that. It was like, you got to stop apologizing. Yeah. So I went through a run of like just crying at the episode. And it was really cool because all these men wrote in. Now I feel comfortable crying.
Oh, my God.
They like, I pulled over on the side of the road and just cried with it. And like, but Nick and I used to apologize. And then Nick and I changed it because someone wrote in, is like, stop apologizing. Yep. Like, it's beautiful what you're doing, but it's actually not grace to apologize for it every time. So you're us.
Yes.
Like, mind to cry. It's a beautiful thing. It'll make me like, and it's because I feel safe with you. And like, and I've just been genuine. Like, and I, it's not a performative thing. It's just, this is who I am.
Yes.
This is like, this is me feeling comfortable to be myself. And it's this beautiful thing. I cry lots. Like, the final thing, because I know I've been talking about this, but, and I don't know if I've said this story to you personally before, but when Evie was three, she was like, well, she's still like this. She was like, I want to be a boy. And I was there, and Annalise was like, why do you want to be a boy? That's interesting. And she's like, because boys don't cry. She's three. She'd already learned that. And Annalise is like, my dad cries all the time and kind of jokingly. And I was like, I know you mean it in the lighthearted way, but be careful about saying that's funny that I cry all the time. And I do. I just like, I just find myself doing that. And I do it, as I said, in clinic. I do it like, in the podcast, but I do it in my real life as well, where I just get emotional thinking about this stuff, because it's, I've got a sense of temperament, I'll always have it. But I just really care about this, and I get to think about it and work in that space and all that stuff. But it's, it's this huge privilege. But I'm terrified, if I'm being honest, about my three little ones. It's this huge privilege to just get to observe their journey. But I'm just like, man, how do I set them up to have a different story to me, to be still gentle in the world but also tough enough, like, that kind of idea of what true resilience is, not these two things or three things. And I think that's that's how I look back and think. It's a very long answer, but that's what I look back and yeah. that they remember.
And, you know, I can't guarantee you this, but I guess where I sit, I want to say to you, you're already doing it. Yeah. It's already different. It's already different because you can, you acknowledge it. It's already different because you can understand where you've come from. It's already different because even though the pain may still be big and it might not be safe enough yet, you can recognize it. It's already different. It has already changed because there is an awareness and there's a consciousness there that your mum, maybe she didn't have, she was just doing the best she could, you know, all those things. But already, this is what I often see, it's already changed because we're sitting there asking these questions. We're asking, how can we do it differently? We are being curious of like, ah, this is what I want for them. Already it's going to be different.
Yeah. Thanks, Isla. I hear that. And I don't know if I'll ever feel it because I've never felt like what I've done is enough.
Yes.
Always like, you know, nothing that other people would be like, isn't that cool that happened? Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this is I've got the next thing.
Yeah.
That's what I've got to go to now.
Yeah.
And I just... So I really appreciate you saying
that. Yeah. I want to say, Billy, you know, thank you so much for your honesty and your rawness, which is such a gift for everybody because it is like, and especially someone that people look up to, which I know has got its stuff with, but I think this is, again, where we make changes because people can look at us from the outside and when we're real and when we're honest and when we're vulnerable, it gives them permission to do the same, you know, because, and this was one of the reasons for this podcast. If we could see behind everybody's story, we would have nothing but compassion because we would understand where we've all come from. And if we stood in their shoes, we would probably do the same thing in how we've behaved, survived, all that kind of stuff. And that is my great hope. You know, that feels like a bit of my work at the moment is for us to understand this humanness that we all have and drop the judgments within it. And have a bit deep compassion for where we stand because for me that is where we're going to have so much more of a chance changing this world and making it a safer place if we look through that lens of love and compassion for each human.
Yeah, what a beautiful mission and, like, thank you for letting me be a small part of it, Lyle, because, yeah, you know how fond I am of you, but it's really cool to do this together with you too.
Mm, thank you. Your heart is what leads you. You know, and it's what I think makes you so beautiful at what you do. And I just want to say your kids are so lucky to have you as their dad.
Yeah, thanks.
Now to finish off, is there anything you want people to know about what you're doing? I mean, your podcast, Pop Culture Parenting, is there?
So I've got a little plugging stuff. But, yeah, Guiding Your Own Minds is probably the best thing we can Guiding Your Own Mind is a social enterprise that all of the work sits within, like any kind of resources that me coming and doing stuff generates all goes back into that to then push stuff out into the community. And, yeah, so if you're interested, please reach out to that amazing team because they're the ones that make all of it happen. And, yeah, it's just really cool to get to do this. So we're always looking for people to collaborate with and then, yeah, the podcast and the book and all that stuff. And we use social media a lot, but I always feel... I don't know about you. I just always feel uncomfortable plugging. So
it's I'm a so bad at... dance, isn't it? Trying not to be salesy, but also like, hey, I've got this thing going on, and it's weird. That's why it can be good to outsource it. Hey, I know it's a weird dance, isn't it? But it's necessary.
You've been really helpful at me figuring that, so I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Well, I just want to say it's such a privilege to know you, and thank you for your time. And I just want to thank you on behalf of the world for the world for the work that you do because it makes a difference.
Thanks.
Thank you. Oh, that was such a beautiful, tender episode with Billy. I mean, what just stands out to me so much is his incredible heart and the passion for the work that he does. Yet also I think as I reflect on it, it's so much about we can be in the world doing this work and yet still having our own struggles, still having parts of us that show up, still having to heal all our work and trauma. And I think it really reminds me, no matter who we are, we've all got a story. And I think there is the opportunity for us to keep leaning in and doing that work. And I am so grateful for Billy's vulnerability. I mean, he is all heart, that man, not only with the work that he does with children and families, but who he is as a person. And, you know, it really touches me just how vulnerable he would be, he's willing to be, and to what he shares, because I think it gives us all permission to be human, to be real. Even when we're doing great big stuff in the world, you know, we've all got those little parts that feel scared, those parts that feel not enough, those parts that don't feel seen. It is such an ongoing journey still, isn't it? Doing the work, leaning into it, healing our stories so that we can turn up for our children in a whole other way. So I wonder if this episode touched you. I'd love for you to share your thoughts and reflections and, you know, let me know what it is that moved you in our conversation. Thanks for sharing this time with me. You can find my book, Own Your Story, at bookshops or listen to the audiobook on Audible. I even read it myself. You can stay connected with Humans Being on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. We love to hear from you, so please leave a comment, question, or contemplation. And visit my website, laylstone.com.au, where you'll find heaps of great resources and courses for you to explore. This podcast is produced by Nigel Carboon, recorded by the crew at We Make Online Videos, and our original music is created by Josh Reed. Humans Being is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wadawurrung people. We pay respect to their unique and diverse cultures and to elders past, present, and future. Until next time, stay connected and don't forget to be human.